Welcome to Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, a weekly interactive program on some of the most controversial breaking issues of today. Here now is your host, David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group, and author of Headlines.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Headlines. This week, we'll be speaking about Bashert. Is there really only one? And other shidduch questions as well. Our guest is the renowned Rav, Rabbi Daniel Neustadt, Yoshev Rosh of Vad HaRabbanim of Detroit. If you have any questions, please email them to questions@headlinesbook.com. Again, that's questions@headlinesbook.com. Next week, the topic will be shaking hands with someone of the opposite gender. Business as usual or Yerig Val Yaver? Our guest will be Rav Arye Leibowitz, Morid Asra of the Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere. Again, any questions, please email them to questions@headlinesbook.com. You can listen at WMCA.com or at NachumSiegel.com. This week's topic is Bashert. Is there only one? And other shidduch questions. Welcome, Rav Neustadt.
Hello. Good evening.
So let me start with the obvious question. The Gemara says, "Arboim yom kaidem avlad, kaidem yitziras avlad, bas pliny lepliny." So, is there only one shidduch for everybody?
Good question. Is there only one shidduch for everybody? There's one suggested shidduch for each person. Probably what the Gemara means is that before the people are born, before they're created, before conception, the Rabbi Shalala matches them up and he says, this person is worthy of that person. That's a good match. That's the way it should be. But we need to remember, we need to understand that everything in this world, all of Yiddishkeit and everything that we believe in, is all based on bechira, on personal choice. The Rabbi Yishalelem doesn't force us to do anything. He gives us options. He gives us choices. He wants us to choose what is best for us, uvachay to bachayim. But in the end, the bottom line, it's up to us. We have to make our own decisions. That's true of every mitzvah and every aveira in the Torah. Hashem wants us to keep Shabbos, but he doesn't force us. He can't make us. If we choose not to keep Shabbos, he's disappointed. It's an aveira. It's something that will haunt us, but he can't force us. Shidduchim is no different than any other mitzvah. To marry a wife is a mitzvah. Peruv Erevu is a mitzvah. So the Rabbi Shalom sets the stage. He tells us what's best for us, what he recommends, what he thinks is the best match. Then, ultimately, we need to make the final decision. And if we choose to do something that is not what he meant, well, we have the option because he doesn't force us. So we can somehow meet that person that was intended, that was recommended for us, and for whatever reason, sometimes good ones, sometimes not such good ones, we said no. We didn't have enough money, didn't have enough looks, it didn't have this, it didn't have what I wanted, whatever the case may be. We said no when we met that person. And that means that we had a choice, and we made the wrong choice. So wrong choices have consequences.
And how would somebody know? A boy or a girl go out, and they're not sure if it's the right one or the wrong one. How do they know if they just said no to the one that they was Arboim Yoim, that was the one that was chosen for them?
Right. That's the million-dollar question. How do you know whenever you would make a decision, a major decision in your life, difficult to know what's the right decision? In this case, in the case of Shidduchim, a person needs to really prepare himself very well to what exactly is important, what is the foundation of a good house, how do you make a bais neman b'Yisrael, the ingredients that are required for that, versus external things versus things which are may seem important when you're young, but they're not really important in the long haul, in the long run, of what really makes a Bais member be strong. So you need to make a list of things that you need, that you must have, that are critical to make a shidduch. And as you go out with the other person, you need to see if they're pleasant and their company is good and there is an attraction between the two parties. And they seem to cover all of the needs that you consider important, not the things that you don't consider important. Now, this is the real work. The real work is before you go out, before you're in the parish of Shidduchim, to determine what's really critical and what maybe is dessert, what is extra. When a person understands what he really, really needs and he finds that person that he really, really needs, that's the siman in Hashemayim that that's the right person. As long as you can get along with them, you don't have to be head over heels just because you went out with them. But you have to be attracted to each other and you have to like each other and you have to enjoy being in the company of each other. And then you have to have that mental list of what is required for you to be able to build the proper Bais Nem B'Yisrael. And then if you say no on other reasons, then you may miss your calling. You may. We don't know for sure. We'll never know for sure. But you may be missing the right one.
I mean, if you say yes to somebody because maybe you will be vata, could it be that maybe you said yes to the wrong one too?
It could be. But nevertheless, it could be. Look, this is something that we don't know. This is min hashamayim, and we don't know. But we have certain criteria that we need to follow. And, of course, a person doesn't know what to do. He needs to ask his rebbe, people that are experienced. You know, when we're young, we make decisions about shidduchim that affect us our entire life. And that's one of the problems of being young. But nevertheless, that's why people have rebbeim and teachers, and they have to consult with them. But the basic criteria is the way I said. You have to make sure that you know what's really important versus what can make, we can't understand everything. We can only do with what Chazal tell us, and we have to work with that.
Yeah, so, there is a possibility that, you know, kaviyachal, there are things we don't understand, and bad things do happen to good people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We don't understand most things. We don't understand a lot of things. We don't see schar and einish in this world in that, you know, very clearly. We see good people suffering and bad people profiting. So, yeah, that's for sure part of the whole puzzle.
So here's a question from Yitzhak from the West Side. He says, do you feel that Rosh Yeshivas are truly honest when giving information about boys? He says, most of them don't even know the boys, and isn't that problematic when parents call, and I'm not sure if this is a boy or a parent, but he says, how do they give information when they may not even know the boy very well, and how do we trust this information?
I think that most Rosh Yeshivas, at least the ones that I know, if they don't know the boy well, they'll be honest with that and say, I just don't know him that well. I don't think that you're going to get a Rosh Yeshiva who is going to make believe that he knows the boy without saying that he really doesn't. That I don't think happens. What does happen, I believe, is like this. Many people call Rosh Yeshiva for information about the boys. They don't know the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva doesn't know them. In many cases, the Rosh Yeshiva is not going to open up and spill private information that he knows about a student due to his talks with him and due to any interaction that he had to a stranger, to somebody that he doesn't know. The right way to do this is, if a person really wants to know what the Rosh Yeshiva thinks about the potential shidduch, it's not just to give him a phone call and say, hello, my name is Rosenberg from Brooklyn, and I want to know information about this boy. People call me all the time also about information, and I don't share real information with people that I don't know. This stuff is private. This stuff is secret. The right way to do it is, of course, make an appointment with the Rosh Yeshiva. Speak to him in person. Tell him who you are, what your aspirations are, who your daughter is, what exactly you should be looking for. And then the Rosh Yeshiva, with his wisdom, will see if this is a match. He doesn't have to tell you information if it's not nigea, if it's not applicable. A lot of times, it's not applicable, and he doesn't want to get involved in it, and he's not going to tell you. But if he knows you and he knows the girl and he sees that this is something that there's to talk about, he'll be open with you and say, this boy does this, he has this smile, he has that chassar, the different things. People don't know how to ask properly. The reason why the reshivas don't answer properly is because they're not asked properly. You have to know how to ask. You have to know how to ask straight questions. If you're going to just say, does this boy come to Seder? Yeah, he comes to Seder. He's not going to tell you he comes 9:30, 10 o'clock. He's not going to get involved in that. He doesn't know who he's talking to. This is not information to be broadcast to anybody. The art of getting information is an art. You have to work on it. You have to prepare for it. You have to know how to ask and who to ask. It's very cumbersome and it's very detailed and it takes a lot of work. But a good shidduch takes a lot of work. Most of the work of a good shidduch is the information stage. And people don't do that very well. They don't ask the right questions. They don't do it in the proper scenarios. And this is one of the reasons why the reshivas answer in the way they do. Because otherwise, there's no privacy. There's no discretion. There's no relationship that the reshiva could have with the bachur when he knows that everything's just broadcast to everyone indiscriminately.
So. Which leads to another question, Reb Daniel. When it comes to hishtadlus, there are parents who they'll move a mountain. They'll go from one end of the earth to the other, and there are parents who do very little. How would you describe what's a parent's and also a boy and a girl's obligation for hishtadlus? What are you mechuyev to do? And where do you say, it's like by Yosef. You've gone beyond hishtadlus. Where are you supposed to be a maimon? And what's the level of hishtadlus?
We can't compare ourselves to Yosef. The complaint against Yosef was that he saw that the hanhaga of Hashem along the way is so clearly, so that he's being led every day. The hashkacha pratis that he was able to see, that's why maybe he shouldn't have looked for hishtadlus, or maybe he did too much hishtadlus, perhaps, according to that chazal. I think that us, today, in Shiduchim, there really is no limit to the amount of hishtadlus that you have to do. You have to be hishtadl as much as is humanly possible, as much as you have to put in all that effort, all that work. It requires a lot of work. And there is no real limit to hishtadlus. Establish means that the person has to do whatever he can. He has to be aggressive. He has to make phone calls. He has to reconnect with maybe old friends that you haven't spoken to in a long time. You have to be out there. There is no limit to establish when it comes to shidduchim, because this is the mitzvah, this is the obligation that everybody has to do for their child or for themselves.
Agavorcha, I just want a maimer a muzga. It says by Yaakov Avinu, when he sent Yehuda to negotiate with Yosef on behalf of Binyamin, so he said, take some light and some spices. Mm-hmm. And Rashi says, now that I've done everything possible, he says, now I will be mispal.
Mm-hmm.
So by Yaakov, you see, he said, everything that I possibly could do. So right. You see, by Yaakov, it seems Hishtadlus was told the end, and the same thing you see before in Vayishlach. You see, when it comes to Esav, he was Vayachat, says Hamach, he split the Machnais, he sent Minchas, and he's not criticized for it. So it's ironic that Yosef is criticized, and Yaakov twice, and the Lashon of Rashi is Asisi Kol Mashi Yecholti, Ein Lanu Elul Espal. So you see, it's interesting, some type of a little bit of a steer in Chazal on that. Let me ask you another question. The Gemara says that this is a question from Chaim from Baruch Park. I got all these questions emailed to me.
Mm-hmm.
The Gemara says you're supposed to Yivdaik Bachel. You're supposed to judge a girl by her brothers, family, and particularly by her brothers. Some Paiskim say in the days of Beis Yaakov, as in modern days, we assume that each girl has developed her own hashkafis. How would you define where is family? When do we look at the brothers? How do we look at the girl? In modern times, is it possible to say that Yivdaik Bachel has lost some of its importance?
I think so. I think that in modern times, Yivdaik Bachel is less important than it was. And it's like you mentioned, in the olden days, a girl was completely the product of her home. completely. And the way her brothers went, many times, that's the way the sisters were. They were raised by the same parents. The mother was completely in charge of the chinuch of the little children and certainly the girls. Everything that the girl knew, she knew from home. So checking out the brothers was a good indicator. Today, it's much less so. It's not just that the girls are products of this educational system in many cases, but the influences of the outside world. I mean, a girl can have great brothers, but it doesn't mean that she's so great, because unfortunately we are subject to so much outside influence, so much interference into Kedusha, that everybody's affected. So that indicator, it might be something. We can't discount what Chazal tell us altogether, but it's not as clear of an indicator as it was in the days past. What's very important, of course, when it comes to family, people use yichus. They think yichus is important, and a lot of people go for a distinguished family, a well-known family. And that's generally not a proper, well, we said before that a person has to focus on what's really critical to make a good house. Well, yichus is not. Yichus is extra credit. Some people have it, some people don't have it. But yichus means nothing in the qualities of the person, of the potential spouse, and how they will be able to run a Bais Nem and Bisrael. Yichus is something from the past. When I say yichus, I mean a distinguished family, a well-known family, a rich family. Those are not important things. That's not important. What's important is, are they decent people? Are they Yerushalayim? Are they honest people? Are they people that you could trust and deal with them, and their word is a word? And that's important. That's not yichus. People maybe mix up those terms, but that's just good midas, good family. And that remains as important as ever, because a girl who sees proper midas in her home will usually, again, nothing is 100%, will be a product of that home. And a girl that sees not such good midas at home will certainly pick that up, and they'll be more difficult to live with. So that remains very important. But the other external stuff, are they famous people or not famous people? That's not important.
So this leads to another question. If Yivdaik Bachel is somewhat mitigated by the lifestyles we live today, how would you define a lot of the other parameters that Chazal have Shteldevek in Shidduchim? For example, Tavla Meis of Tandu, Isha Yatsanis, Leia Yatsanis Haisa, Isha Ksheira Oyser Etzain Baila. I mean, how has the definition of marriage changed since the times of Chazal? Like the Rambam writes, "An isha layaziv beis ayosim mipamech as bechaydish." I mean, obviously today it's. I don't know anybody who does that, and if they did, you'd probably be reasons for divorce, right? I mean, when Shlomo HaMelech sings Eishes Chayil, said Eishes Chayil, to which one of his thousand wives was he referring? Has the definition of marriage changed today so that a lot of these Maimorim, which give a definition of who we should be looking to, has changed as well?
Not really. I mean, society has changed, but the definition of marriage has not changed. The women go out today, yes, they're not anymore only busy inside their homes doing laundry all day long like they used to do. Yes, society has changed, and the role of women within society has changed. But the definitions of marriage remains the same. Tavla Meis of Tandu is still very much in vogue. It's very much felt. And most of the Chazal's concepts and smarts and wisdom remains the same. Like everything else, we have to apply it to our maybe modern days. The lifestyle of people has changed. And we live our lives differently, but I don't think that it impacts marriage differently. It's still the aside-ness of a relationship between a husband and a wife, which are primarily inside their home, that hasn't changed. That's the same, and it should remain the same. Unfortunately, some people try to change that, but no, that's not good.
Well, don't you think? Let's say the European wives that did everything for their husbands, they stood up and they ran and they brought them tea and coffee, and in America, the husband expects it to be more of a partnership than more than the woman who's just a subservient. Do you see that difference at all in the American attitude than it used to be in Europe or the way it was 1,000 years ago?
Yeah, because the role of women has changed. They used to be completely subservient and secondary to the men, and today they play more of a prominent role. But it's also true to remember that for a good marriage to really succeed, everybody has to know their role. And yes, the male is usually more dominant, and the female is usually more submissive, and that's their very nature. And for a good show of bias to take place, that component needs to be there. Somewhat modified, it's a little different, but basically, inherently, that remains the same. That player has got a marriage. One of the reasons why there is so much divorce and there is so much breakdown of marriages in the secular world is because men and women think they're equal. And everything that the man has to do, the woman has to do, and she has to have an equal say in everything, and he has to do. It's not like that. There are certain roles which the Torah wants men to have, certain roles which the Torah wants women to have, and inherently they remain the same. They are somewhat modified due to the modern day, but the shorashim in their root, the yesodus of a healthy marriage, cannot change. And those that change them, really, it doesn't end up good. It doesn't end up well.
Okay, so you're saying intrinsically they're the same, but nuances change with
right.
Every locale and every time.
That's right.
If a boy, here's a question, Yosef from Baltimore. If a boy or a girl were divorced from an unusually short marriage, say a month, is it correct or incorrect that people stay away from dating them? Or should we consider them more as singles?
Well, you can't make a general rule because, of course, every case is different. But I'll tell you a basic breakdown. When a marriage lasts, let's say, a real short time period, like a month, one indication is very clear that there's something seriously wrong. It's not something slightly wrong. It's not something which is not compatible, because when things are not slightly not compatible, you work it through. You go through the shana rishana difficulties, and you manage most people. But when a shidduch or a marriage breaks abruptly and quickly, obviously there's a serious issue. So that's good. Now, it depends who has the serious issue. It's sometimes both, but often it's really more one party has fallen for the wrong spouse. The information was bad. Somebody lied. Somebody didn't say something but a mental health issue or maybe a physical, and now it's coming out really clear. So this person now is back on the market, right? They had a fast divorce and they're back in the parsha. Well, it depends. Where was the problem? Is this single person, maybe he or she is the real problem, and therefore you can't consider them as singles, then they are the real issue. On the other hand, if they're the ones who were the victims, and the real issue was with the other party, and now you are being read the innocent party, so then yes, you can consider them as singles. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes,
it depends.
It
depends who you're talking about. It depends where the problem is.
And how would you classify a broken engagement?
Much less than that, because today, and I'm sure it was always that way, engagements are sometimes made hastily, sometimes under pressure. Well-meaning parents, well-meaning shadchanim make pressures that the young people who are 18, 19, 20 don't know how to withstand. And then when they agree, the next day or a week later, all of a sudden, what did I get myself into? And that's not a flaw. That's just normal human reactions and emotions. You get carried away. And then when you wake up and you are no longer drunk with the scene, then you analyze it and say, I made a mistake. People are allowed to make mistakes. That's not a flaw. actually everybody makes mistakes, and that's normal. So a broken engagement generally should not be a blemish that people should not go out with, and we do consider them almost like a regular single. But again, you have to know a little bit why the should have broke. It's also possible that it wasn't just a mistake or a hastily pressured situation, but a serious flaw was found out. And then you need to know if that the party that you might date is the one with the serious flaw.
So here's a question from Sarah from Cedarhurst. It's a touchy question. Do you feel that a rabbi should be taking on matters of couples' questions, or should singles and engaged couples be going directly to therapists instead?
The answer is very clear that it's no question that they have to end up, almost in all situations, they have to end up by a professional therapist, whatever the case may be, whatever they need. But also true that in almost all situations, it is preferable, it's recommended, it's almost a must that they need to speak to a rav first. Now, to speak to a rav first, not for therapy. Rabbanim are generally not qualified therapists. They did not go to school for that. They're not trained for that. And Rabbanim really should not practice therapy. That's not their role. But from personal experience, I could tell you that so many shalom bayis issues, so many issues that come up with a couple are a lot of times, let's call it miscommunication or misunderstanding of halacha. There are so many areas where one party thinks, oh, this is such a halacha, and my husband doesn't do this. It creates a distrust and a lack of respect to the other party that is destroying their shalom bayis. And many times when you'll have that discussion with a knowledgeable rav, with a paisik, somebody who knows, what? This wasn't required? This is something that, oh, I was so sure that this happens repeatedly over and over again. And we find that when we clarify that, not always, but many of these issues, in particular things that have to do with sneis issues and with money issues and with minhagim, that a mother saw by a wife saw by her mother or by her grandmother, and she thinks that that's the only way you can go, and other such things, many such things, it is a rav can have a tremendous impact. Oh, this is a different minig, or this is a different halacha. You know, you're probably aware, most good yeshiva bachrim, maybe big lumdim, and they spend many years learning, but they don't know that much halacha most of the time. And they assume certain things, and they're wrong many times, because they haven't really studied and learned it properly. And then it leads to big miscommunication and shalom bayis problems in the family, and a rav has a major role in trying to correct that. So therapy is not always the answer. It's not always the issue. A lot of times it's religious dvarim shebinoyim lebinoch that happened inside the household that must be clarified, and only a rav could do that. And actually going to a therapist for that is not only not beneficial, but it can actually be bad, because not all therapists are aligned with the Torah Hashkafa. Some of them mock Torah Hashkafa. Some of them don't believe in having too many children. Some of them advise you against Baas Torah. So another reason why you have to go to a rav first is because the Rabbanim are familiar with the proper therapists. They could guide you to who is in tune with Torah Hashkafa and who's not. I know here in Detroit, we have a whole system set up that the people come to the Rabbanim, and then we have under the Vada Rabbanim, which I head, there's this person who's in charge and directing people to which therapy is best suited for them. Who is a therapist that understands a Torah Jew, that could counsel properly, and over many years, we have established a whole system where we know where to send the people to. You're going to try to do this on your own, you often will fail and not do it right. So it's very important to first consult with a halachic authority, rather a person who knows your situation.
Reb Daniel, let me follow that up with a question, and this is from me, not sent in by email, but I'm curious. It was Rabbi Yisrael Salanta's yard site this week. In fact, it may have even been today or yesterday. And they say over, Rabbi Yisrael used to say, We have to be concerned about our friend's gashmius, his physical well-being, and our own spiritual well-being. In a marriage, do you think that holds true as well? Like, husbands and wives should say, listen, your level of how you daven, it's really between you and the Rabbi Nishalem. My job is to make sure, you know, either I take care of you, you take, you know, you take care of me, I take care of you. Your own religiosity, as long as it's not blatantly out of the parameters of halacha, is sort of within, I have to respect that it's within the confines of your understanding. Do you think that would be appropriate or not?
I think it's very appropriate, and it's probably the only way to do it, because if you're going to give mussar and if you're going to criticize, we all know that criticism does not work well with a marriage, particularly a criticism of a husband to a wife. And as long as what the wife or the husband, whatever the case may be, is doing something which is not blatantly and clearly forbidden, and basically according to all opinions or according to mainstream halacha, it's completely not the task of the other party to criticize him for it. The way to do it, not that a person should not try to elevate the spiritual components of his house, but you can't do it by criticism and you can't do it by fighting. You have to do it by personal example. It's if you behave in a higher plane, that sets the tone for the house, and that brings Kedusha into the house and elevates the Shabbos and elevates the Shabbos table. And the discussion becomes more spiritual and the behavior becomes more focused. And by like anything else, if you want things to be done, work on yourself. Work on yourself, that's mashpia on your sviva and elevates everybody else. However, if you're going to criticize any misbehavior that you think is not in accordance with your standards, you're going to have a difficult time having peace in your home.
We're speaking to Reb Daniel Neustadt, the Yoshev Rosh of the Vada Rabbanim of Detroit. Reb Daniel, here's a question from Naomi from Lakewood. I'm a single girl, and I have not been read many shidduchim my entire life. I've been sending money to many of the schoolists in Eretz Yisrael. Am I doing a wise thing, or is it a waste of my money?
You know, tzedakah has a tremendous power. We know that the schosim of tzedakah is important. And she should do so measurably. You know, it's something that's part of what we do. We give tzedakah. She should not overdo it. She should not give more than meiser. She needs to put that money away for mitzvah shem when she gets a shidduch. But she should do somewhat. It should follow all the other halachas of tzedakah. There's a concept of ani yircha kaidvin. There is a concept of eretz yisrael. She needs to ask a shaila, maybe where the best money, where the best way to spend her tzedakah dollars is. But to certainly just fall for these messages that they give you, that they tell you this story, that story, that's not our derech. That's not our messiah from our rebbeim. This is not what we do. We believe in tzedakah, of course. Tzedakah. It saves people from a lot of things, and you should give tzedakah like the halacha demands, which is basically meiser, and go more than that, and putting all your effort into that is just misleading.
I'm going to leave you with one last question, and there are really two questions, and one is unfair, and you'll tell me whether you can even respond, because yeah, I don't know how I would respond to it, and the other one is, this is from a parent. He says, I have a daughter who's dating. How important is it for me to ask how well the boy learns? Because he will only be in Kailul for a year or two. So how important is this, and will this truly affect his skills as a father and a husband?
Well, first you have to know the girl. Is the girl looking for a Talmid Chacham? Would the girl be disappointed if she marries somebody who is does not know how to learn, who is very weak in learning, who barely knows how to learn a Blat Gemara? You have to know your daughter. It's not everybody set out for learning. It's not a chiv, for an obligation for somebody to marry a boy in learning. You have to match it up to the level of the girl. It has to be a match. If she is looking for a Ben Torah who can learn, who will spend many hours in learning, and she's not going to get that. That's going to be a disappointment in the marriage, and it won't work. So it really depends on the girl.
Well, do you think that, I would just take the position that if a boy was in yeshiva and didn't learn seriously, is that a precursor of maybe he won't work seriously or do other things seriously as well?
No, not necessarily, because many boys do not have what we call zitzleish to sit down and study deep Gemara for a long time. Our educational system, unfortunately, is not really suited for those kinds of boys, and many of them fall through the cracks. But many of them, when they leave yeshiva and they have a different environment and that focuses on their strengths, do much better. They could be great husbands without being a great Talmid Chacham. It's not necessarily one is connected to the other. Girls who are looking for a boy that's learning is not because they're looking for the best possible husband. It's because they want to be married to a Talmid Chacham. They think that they're taught, and they what are we here for in this world? We're here to learn Torah. I want to have a chelik in that. I want to share in the Torah of my husband. Not necessarily does that mean he'll be the best husband. There could be good husbands who are not great Talmid Chacham. So the first thing that you have to look for is stability, normalcy, honesty, a person that you could spend time with and enjoy their company. And then, if you are the type of a girl that wants only a Talmid Chacham because that's the level that you are on, yeah, of course, you have to look for that as well. But that's secondary to a person who has midas, who can just be a regular, stable, normal person. Because if you don't have that, you don't have anything.
I have one last question. This is from Leah from Chicago. She says, I am 24 years old, and I've been reading avidly everything that Mr. Rechnitz has been writing about the Shidduch crisis, including that 12% of girls will never get married because there are simply no boys for them. I'm quite terrified. Can you give me some advice as how to deal with this?
You know, I don't know if the statistics are true or not true. I don't know if it's true across the board. Not all segments of Klal Yisrael are the same. There are Hasidim, and there are Yeshivalites, and there's Sfardim, and there's working girls, working boys. It's not, I think that's a misleading statistic that may apply to a certain specific segment of the population. But and if it does, it does. I mean, there's nothing we can do about it. The only thing that maybe we can do about it is like this. We spoke before about Ishtablis. Part of Ishtablis needs to be, we can't lock ourselves, girls and boys, but most importantly girls, cannot lock themselves into a certain position and say, this is the kind of a boy I want, and I'm not going to compromise, and I'm not going to go look for something else. That's not healthy. Sometimes your dreams don't come true, or your fantasies, or whatever it is that you thought that you'd be marrying. We don't know. We don't know if that's what Hashem had in store for you. It may be that that's what you wanted, and it may be that it's not going to work out for you for whatever reason. And a person has to be more open-minded and grow their field of potential chassadim and potential boys. I think that a big percentage of those people that never get married, and it's not a criticism, but I just think that it's a fact, is because they lock themselves into only one type. Only that will do. And you're limiting yourself. And by limiting yourself, that hurts you. And who says that that's what the Rabbi Shalom says that that's what you should limit yourself to? Who gave you that decision? Who empowered you to limit yourself? And that is, I think, wrong established. And if you open yourself up, you have a much greater chance of not being part of that bad statistic that was quoted before.
Well, we want to thank Rabbi Daniel Neustadt from Detroit. Detroit is truly fortunate to have somebody as wise and circumspect as him in their city, as the Rosh of the city. Thank you very much, Rav Neustadt, for coming on to our program.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
This week's Parsha discusses a topic that's really important to all of us. It talks about the truma that was given to the Mishkan, the gift that was given by all of Klal Yisrael to build the Mishkan. And the Pasuk says, V'yikhu li truma meis kol ish asher yidvenu libay. Everybody, all of Klal Yisrael, contributed to the Mishkan. Now here's a very interesting concept. A lot of people don't believe that they have something to contribute. If you would ask a lot of people, they would say, you know me, I'm just a cog in the wheel. I do my job, I go about it, I go to my office, I go to my school, I go to my yeshiva, I do whatever the job is, I'm home, I cook, I clean. There's nothing special about me. There's nothing about me that makes me a contributor. But the Pasuk says otherwise. Hashem says to every one of us, bring me a gift. You have a gift that I want. There's something special about you. Now here's something interesting. If you didn't have a gift, Hashem wouldn't have created you. He doesn't have a lot of extra time. If He created you, it's because you have something special to contribute. Now look at the trumas that were given to the Mishkan. Some people gave gold and silver. And in life, some people write a check. They give their hard work, the money that they earned. Some people give tcheles, argaman. They give color. They give warmth. They give compassion. Other people give shemen lamoir. Those were also some of the 13 contributions. What does shemen lamoir means? They don't have money. They're not necessarily warm people, but they'll give advice, enlightenment, spirituality, religion. Everybody has something to contribute to the Mishkan. The Mishkan is a mashal, is a metaphor for life, for this world. Everybody has something to contribute. You say nobody believes in you. Nobody trusts you. Nobody thinks you're special. Well, maybe your mother does, but except for that, nobody does. Well, guess what? Some of the greatest people who've ever lived, nobody's believed in them either. Do you know that the greatest of the Impressionist painters was Vincent van Gogh? Of the top 10 paintings ever sold at auction, 3 of them were Van Gogh's. They sold $150 million, $130 million. In his life, Van Gogh painted some 300 paintings. You know how many he sold in his life? 1. For today, what would be the equivalent of $1,600? He died in a poorhouse. Today, you can't get your hands on a Van Gogh painting. Unheralded genius is an axiom. He was totally unappreciated. Does that mean his work wasn't great? The world is full of special people who nobody believes in. Do you know that the Meiri, one of the greatest of the Rishonim, the compendium of his work is greater than any Rishon, is broader. There's more writings from the Meiri than from any Rishon, Ramban, Rashba, Ritva. He was discovered in the last 150 years. He lived anonymously in some town in Provence. We know nothing about him. Zero. Nobody quotes him. And today, he studied endlessly, millions of hours. He came anonymously. He lived his entire life anonymously. He struggled anonymously. Now we know the great Meiri. Maybe the widest body of writing of any of the Rishonim. So the Pasuk doesn't say that anybody has to believe in you. It just has to say, Mikol ish asher yidvenu libay, you have to believe in yourself. That if Hashem created you, there's a reason why you're here. Or He wouldn't have created you. You have something to give. Parsha of Truma follows immediately after the Parsha of Mishpatim. Mishpatim talks about a slave, somebody who sold himself into slavery because he didn't believe he could survive on his own. What a sad statement it is. Somebody wakes up in the morning and says, I have nothing to contribute. Do you know that we are called B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of Hashem, in the image of God? God is called the Creator, Bore Olamim, Yetzer Olamim. He's a creator. If we were made in His image, that means we are creators too. What a sad statement it is of the Eved, the slave, who says, I have nothing to create. And that is why we pierce his ear. Hashem said, I created you to be free men, to be avadim only of God, not of another man. That's a diminishment of your Tzelem Elikim. You say that you failed. You say that you couldn't. Everybody fails. Everybody can't. Everybody has setbacks. Those are just excuses. Those are crutches. Don't grab that crutch. Don't hold on to those excuses. You'll find your mission. And that's what Truma comes to tell you. You failed in the past. Lose that crutch. Lose that excuse. There's one other person who sold into slavery, and that's the thief. There's only one person in the entire Torah who sold as a slave, and that is a thief. Now, here's something interesting. There are 613 commandments. Only one, the violator of just one commandment, is sold as a slave, and that is a thief. I ask you, if somebody mugs somebody, chops his arm off, and according to Beis Din, he has to pay tzar ripushevus boishas, nezik tzar ripushev, five damages, different types of damages. He owes him $500,000 and he can't pay. Did they throw him? Did they sell him as a slave for saying, I don't have the money to pay? No. If somebody robs, rapes, anything, all these damages, is he sold? Burn somebody's house down? No. If he is a thief, he's sold. What's the logic to it? Why? And I'll tell you why. Because slave is the person who's, a thief is the person who says, I don't have the ability to create. I can't make my own living. I can't do something. I can't go out. I can't contribute. The only thing that I can do is take something that somebody else has done. I have lost my ability to be a creator. I am not anymore B'Tselem Elohim. I have a diminished Tselem. I am a slave. So Truma, Rabbi Zevin says, the word Truma is Milashin Rome, which means uplifting. When a person recognizes that they have the ability to gift and that they don't need that excuse, they don't need that crutch, when they say, yes, I don't do what you do. I'm not a great, maybe, orator. I'm not a great teacher. I'm not a great scientist. I'm not a great lamb. I have what I'm gifted at. What did Einstein say? He said, a fish, if its whole life it was told, why can't you climb a tree, would live its entire life thinking it was an idiot. Well, a fish was not meant to climb a tree. How many people live their lives thinking that they're not gifted because they're trying to live the gifts of other people? How many people have gifts? Gifts of compassion, gifts of music, gifts of poetry, gifts of touching the hearts of other people, gifts of parenting that are unheralded and unappreciated not only by others but by the very person themselves. So we need Asher Yudven Libay. So in those who gave the gifts of the Mishkan, we had every type. We had Zav, Kesef, Nechayshes, every one of these. Now there's one person who is missing here. You know who that is? The person who has not self-actualized. All of these people had something to contribute. There was the person who had nothing. It says later on in the Parsha, there was the Isha Chachma slave. All she had is wisdom. She did not have anything agricultural. She did not have Ezim. She did not have goals. Even she contributed wisdom. What about a person who has nothing? What did they contribute? They said, look, I know that one day, inside of me, there is some self-realization that will come out. I just don't know what it is yet. What did that person contribute? So the Pasuk says in Vayakel something amazing. It says that there were women who brought their mirrors, the Maris HaTzoveis, and they brought them to the Mishkan. What is the concept? Why did they bring their mirrors? What does a mirror do to God? What does Hashem need a mirror for? Now remember, this is a few thousand years ago. There were no pictures. There were no selfies. There were no iPhones. It was even before film. How did you send a portrait of yourself? They took a mirror. And you know what the mirror was? It was the closest thing you could do to a selfie. And they took these mirrors, these makeup mirrors, and they sent them to Hashem. They sent them to the Mishkan. And you know what the message was? They said, Hashem, God, I don't even know. I haven't actualized. I'm searching for my mission. I don't know who I am. I haven't self-actualized. I haven't come to a realization yet of who I am and what I belong and what my mission is. I don't know what my gift is. But I know one thing for sure. I know you created me in a unique image. Nobody looks like me. But I know you made me in your image, and therefore there is some gift that I have. There's something special about me. So I'm sending you my image. I believe I will find it. I don't know what it is, but I believe I will find it. And that's what I send to you. And that is the Maris HaTzoveis. The Mishnah says in Avos, every person is supposed to believe, Bishvili, for my sake, Nivra HaOlam, the world was created. Just imagine, what an incredible statement. It doesn't just mean that I'm important here, but it means, for my sake, the world was created. Think of it. What other religion has conferred so much dignity on the individual, so much importance to you? You must have a gift if the world was created for you. And it's not just machshava, it's not just philosophical dogma. Halachically, it's that way too. Think of the most important personages in Jewish history. Think of the following situation. King David, the author of Tehillim, is in front of you, and he's in a battle, and he's captured. And somebody comes over to him, and they say, King David, right? David Malka Mashiach, right? They say, you see this ignorant, tailor, most pedestrian, hoi polloi peddler in front of you. If you don't kill him, we will kill you, and then we will let you go. Does halachically he have a right to kill that person? And it could have been David HaMelech. It could have been the biggest Rav. It could have been Rabbi Kiva Eger or Moshe Feinstein. Name who it is, your Rebbe, your Rosh Hashiva, whoever it is, it's him and the most ignorant, poorest, most humble, disheveled, homeless person. They're going to kill one of the two, and they say, here's a gun, shoot that person, or we kill you. What's the halacha? He's not allowed to. We never know who is more important. And that's the law. That's halacha. So it's not just philosophical dogma. It's not just philosophical dogma, but it's really halachically so as well. There was a famous composer called Toscanini. Perhaps the most famous composer in the last 100 years. They say he was once listening to a symphony. And he stopped and he said, you know, there were supposed to be 13 violins in this piece, and there were only 12. And people marveled. And he said, that I could tell there was one violin missing. Every one of us is that violin. You have a gift. Each one of us is one of those violins playing. Next week, we will have Rabbi Arye Leibowitz. The topic will be shaking hands with somebody of the opposite gender, Yerig Valyavar or business as usual. I look forward to seeing you. You can send your questions into questions@headlinesbook.com or listen at WMCA.com or NachumSiegel.com. Thank you. Take care.
If you are enjoying tonight's radio show, please make sure to read David Lichtenstein's important and innovative new book of the same title as this broadcast, Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, published by OU Press. Embark on a fascinating journey through halakha on some of the most important and controversial breaking issues of the day. Available at your local Jewish booksellers and at Amazon.com. Thank you for listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please join us again next week for another edition of Headlines.